unmute. There it is. How about that? Can y'all hear me out? Super. Welcome. Greetings from really, really hot Texas. It's burning up down here. I'm putting all y'all up north in charge of sending some cold weather, please. Real quick. And some rain. Rain would be groovy, too. I totally would be okay with that. My name is Myers Raymer, and I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. And it's such a treat. I can't tell you. It was so emotional sitting here waiting for this meeting to start. Listening to Charlie and Katie, and I always guess get grin ear to ear listening to them. Charlie did pretty good considering all the stuff he'd been through on his throat. He did good, and it's just pretty special. A little earlier, I was out in the garden trying to trim up some tomato plants, and I don't know if I'm the only one. Maybe I'm just getting old, and I'm getting to be kind of tender. I'm trying to cut these little things off these tomato plants, and I'm going, no, you get to live. I'm not going to cut you off, but I'm going to cut. I got to cut that one off. It's just sort of crazy. I just love. I don't know. Maybe I'm not cut out for this garden stuff. Anyhow, my home group is the primary purpose group in Dallas, Texas. It's a bunch of big old lathered up big book guys. It's a book study that's been running 32 years now, and we got 3 meetings a week: Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. We've got Zoom meetings and all those, and I'm going to post the Zoom number in the chat at the end. It'll be on there so that we could, if anybody, unfortunately, it's the same night that Charlie and Katie are doing that primary purpose group in Austin. We're 300 miles apart. No, it's not that far. 200 for sure, maybe. Anyway, y'all could listen to them, and then y'all come listen to us some nights too. It would be fun. It looks like the Zoom thing's going to last a while. We got a lot of folks. We had people from 14 countries there the other night. That's just sort of otherworldly. Pretty emotional talking about birthdays, 85 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you wonder. I heard this guy one time. He said, I just can't see the hand of God in anything, and I'm going, why don't you start with just this one simple fact? You take millions of train wrecks that got sober and managed to hold a deal together, and tell me you can't see God's hand in the middle of that. Without God in the middle of it, we would have destroyed this years and years ago. It's just pretty amazing. It all becomes really worth hanging on to. There's nothing in AA land that I would rather talk about more than this. And this 12-step stuff was pivotal. It changed everything about my program and about my relationships and about everything. And most of you, I think I seem to know all of you. For those that I don't know, Chris, who I lovingly call the evil twin, but I think over the years we've proven that he's not the evil one. But he sobered up 2 months before I did. I know Kathy. Katie and Charlie, when Katie talks about sobering up before Charlie did, Chris will remind me really often, 2 months makes a huge difference, brother. You'll really realize this later. But he took me to my very first meeting, and I wrote one sobriety date, January 15th, 88. And I got to tell you, I fell in love with the program and with the folks in there, and I got and plugged into a really nice group with a lot of nice people. It was an interesting culture in the group that I sobered up in. They were sweethearts, but we talked a lot about a lot of stuff, but 12-step work wasn't one of them, and steps wasn't one of them, and sponsorship wasn't one of them, and a deepening relationship with God wasn't one of them either. But I knew all about your cat, and I knew all about everybody else, and I loved them. There's not a single one of them I wouldn't have taken a bullet for. I absolutely love those folks, and I did great for a long time, and then I crashed and burned, not drunk-wise, but emotionally, got real depressed, got real suicidal, got real goofy. The stuff that Charlie and Katie were talking about, that second surrender deal, at 7 years sober, I know I'm going to drink. It's only a matter of time. I'm simply coming apart, and I can't understand what it is that I need to do. I'm doing everything they're asking me to do, which is just don't drink and go to meetings. Meeting makers make it, but I'm testament. I mean, I'm kind of a poster boy of what happens when, if that's all you're bringing to the table, that's all you got. And so I want to tell you a story real quick. There was a guy that had showed up at our AA group that was a member of another group in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and he was kind of an iconic guy. And he was doing this talk one night. In the middle of his talk, he said, "You know, I just want to make a personal observation. There are good 12-steppers, and maybe there are bad 12-steppers. And you know, I'm just saying as a personal note here, that maybe if you're not a good 12-stepper, you ought to leave that to the good 12-steppers, and you could go, you know, there are other things that you could do in AA." Well, I completely dug what this guy said. I mean, I immediately loved him to death because I already knew that I was going to suck large at 12-step work. I'm not going to be good at it. And so it sort of took away the responsibility. Matter of fact, I'll tell you this as a real quick little side deal. Somebody asked me to drive a bus for a treatment center in which was up in by Denton. And I drove that bus one night. I picked up the little guys on the jitter from the jitter joint and drove them to a meeting and then took them back over there afterwards like that. And guys, I'm telling you right now, for 5 or 6 years after that, if somebody said something about 12-step work, I do this. I go, "Yeah, I drove that bus up there at that treatment center. And yeah, I just like, I just..." Y'all understand how stupid that is? Like, I was gonna milk it for all it was worth, like that. It's so crazy. And then I almost fell apart. I did fall apart, but I didn't drink. And I called Chris, and Chris introduced me to a crusty old guy named Cliff Bishop. And Cliff Bishop got me busy in the work. And it was sort of like night and day stuff. It was like, this is what you know, or what you think you know, and this is what I'm going to teach you. He pulled me aside one night and he said, "Myers, let me tell you something. I think it's important that you understand. Teaching you the steps and teaching you about a relationship with your Creator is going to be the easiest thing in the world to do. Getting you to unlearn all this crap you brought in here is going to be a beat for you and for me." Okay. And I remember laughing at the time going, "Yeah, I get it. I get it." And so there it started. And so for a year, I studied with them, got book smart, did pretty well. I still wasn't sponsoring anybody. Coming up on 2 years with those guys. No, by that time, I'm what, 7, 8, 9? I'm almost 9 years sober at that time. And I remember one night sitting in a meeting watching the faces of the men and women that were sitting in that meeting, and I went, "I'm different. I'm still different." And I pulled him aside, Clifford, and I said, What do I got to do to be like y'all?" And I remember he looked at me, took his glasses off, and he looked at the ceiling for a minute, and he said, "Myers, I'm going to tell you this one time, and then I want you to either do it or go away." And my head went, "Oh, he means go away till Thursday night meeting," because this was Tuesday night. And he said, and then all of a sudden I went, whoa, wait a minute. Maybe he meant go away. And he'd been trying to tell me all along. There were pieces of the big puzzle that were missing, and I was intentionally not doing them because I had bought into hook, line, and sinker what this guy had said, which was, "I'm not going to be very good." There was a speaker one time, I think it was Bob D, that years ago, and said, "We're the fly in our own ointment." But I understand that. I am the fly in my own ointment. I will beat myself up, and I will convince myself that I am the most useless piece of crap out there, that I'm nowhere near qualified to sponsor anybody or to carry the message to anybody. We're sitting in a meeting one night, and this guy reads this thing, and I'm going to read it to you real quick. It just takes 2 seconds like that. At the bottom, page 14 in our book, Bill Wilson's laying in the hospital. "My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead," he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it's just like that." And then perhaps my favorite line in the big book, is this next little line here. My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. Oh, I love that stuff. But in reading it, either Bill Wilson was just talking rhetorically and he didn't mean this. He was just trying to sell books. Or he meant it. Well, then go back through and count how many times he repeats the same thing over and over and over again as we got through this thing. It was one of the most common themes. You book study guys and gals will recognize this. It's the most common theme that is in the book, one of the most common, because they repeat it over and over again. If you want to get sober and live a life transformed, be of service to somebody else. Go carry the message. Which means in order to do that, you're going to have to learn what the message is. And that was the common solution that they talked about over on page 17. You're going to have to know what alcoholism is. Not just your story. We got to take a step or two past just the story. Your story is important. I'm not saying that. But you need to know some more. You need to be able to explain what this disease looks like. And they keep telling us that five different times. They push us back to the chapters on alcoholism to try to get us to understand what it is, so that we could teach it. In box 459, that newsletter thing that comes out of New York, this was probably 10 or 11 years ago, there was an article in there that was talking about how disappointed they were that there were so few people in a huge metropolitan area that they couldn't find anybody to do 12-step work. And the article said, we find it distressing that we have to make as many as 12 calls to get one person that's willing to go do a 12-step call. And the guy said, what was the most distressing was when we called this lady and she said, oh, I couldn't possibly go do a 12-step call tonight. I'm picking up my birthday cake tonight and I really need to do that. I'm just saying, guys, there is a shift in our being in AA. When we're new, we come in and we're takers. We take. And great, that's what we're here for. I mean, that's what other people, they're feeding us. But at some point, we get to make the decision. We get to decide whether or not we're going to remain a taker or whether we're going to shift to a place to where we can be of service and give. And it's life-changing. It changes everything about who you are and how your life is going to unfold. It's all connected to your ability and your willingness to do that. A Clifford told me one time, he said, I want you to go to the Salvation Army. I don't have time to tell the whole story, but let me just say this. They gave me an opportunity to go to the Salvation Army and carry the message. I'd been down there dozens of times carrying books for Clifford and various other things. And so he says, go down there tomorrow night and you can help us do the work. And I said, okay. And so I go down there and then they don't show up. To the very end of Cliff's life, he swore that they didn't set this up. I'm telling you, I mean, I look stupid, but I'm not as stupid as I look. Okay, honest. They rigged it, man. And so I got down there. I walked into this great big kind of a gymnasium thing, and the place is filled with people. And I'm scared spitless. I don't know what to do. I have never ever carried the message. I'm almost 9 years sober, and I've never carried the message. I knew where we were in the book because I was there the last week when Cliff had done it. I usually sat in the back of the room, drank coffee, and messed with my phone. Which is just so stupid. I got through it, got through the evening, and as I'm leaving, I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be just like that place up in Denton where I get to milk this for another 10 years. I'm going, yeah, I carried that message down to the Sally. Yeah, it was pretty cool. Like, I'm two steps from the door, and this guy goes, hey, sir, Myers, can I ask you a question, buddy? Is there any chance you could come back tomorrow night? And I got to tell you, you talk about a mess of emotions. There's a piece of me that was going, oh, dirt. If I had just walked quicker, I could have been out the door and they wouldn't have caught me. And then there was another piece that stood there like I'd been bitch slapped. I mean, my mouth fell open and I went, wait a minute, you want me to come back? And the guy goes, yeah, is there any chance you could do what you did tomorrow night? And I went, oh, yeah, I can. And then I get home, and all the way driving home, I'm thinking, God, what am I going to talk about? I got notes to make. I got this kind of stuff. What am I going to wear? I'm telling you guys, I got up the next morning. My wife, who's my business partner, she would look at me and she'd go, Myers, something's different about you today. What is it? And I went, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm kind of distracted right now. I got to go back over to Salvation Army tonight. And she goes, oh, maybe that's it. And I went, no, that's not it. She was just beating me up. By about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, she said, Myers, you're killing me. Either get to work here, because I was just ignoring everything. I kept looking at the clock going, the meeting is not until 8 o'clock, and I'm sitting over there just, anyway, I went home, just dumped her. I just went home, got dressed, then changed clothes again. It was a big deal for me. I'm just like ready to go over there and do some stuff. I walked into that gym that night like I owned the place. I felt like Jimmy Swaggart. I mean, I'm just sweaty. I got my book up like this, and I'm just like, I know that there's a solution, and I'm going to try to lay out something that looks like a vision of how cool recovery can be. And that's what I did. And after that meeting, five guys raised their hand and said, hey, could you sponsor me? And this other guy goes, me too. And I get all these guys, and I'm thinking, and from that moment on, it was the single most transformational part of my entire existence. Because despite all of my doubts and concerns about whether or not I could or could not do any of this stuff, it was decided for me. And God finally said, hey, come on. Put the big boy pants on. Let's get out there and try to change some lives. And so that's what we did. And it was just the coolest deal. Two things happen when we're willing to do this. It's sort of a funny thing. If you agree to do 12-step work, what you'll find are lives are transformed. Your life and their lives. But in retrospect and looking back, I'm amazed at how often I'd be sitting there going like, golly, I mean, the opportunity for this old crusty guy from West Texas to affect change in the lives of somebody else, and in some cases actually save those lives, this is some heady stuff. It truly, truly is some remarkable stuff. Those two things, 11th step stuff and prayer and meditation and getting doubled down and serious about that stuff, and then being willing to go do 12-step work was huge. Bill Wilson thought it was so important that he wrote an entire chapter on just that, as he repeats the theme over and over and over again. It is not optional. It is not optional. It's a requirement. If you want to live a life a life with no 12-step work in it, I've lived that life, and I guarantee you it's quite a burden. It's not something that you really relish, for sure. The greatest freedom, the greatest peace, the greatest serenity that I had ever known was going to Homeward Bound on the third floor and coming out at night, knowing that I'm getting ready to walk into a building that smells like urine, and it's just this crazy place. And then I would leave that place, and I would stand out there outside that door, and I'd take a deep breath of fresh air, and I would look at the moon coming up over Oak Cliff, and I would just simply melt. It was like this. It's hard to explain. I've never felt anything else in my life that was quite like that experience, and I would do it over and over and over again. And as I get older, I look back and I go, could anything be cooler than the opportunity to change and affect others' lives. A couple of quick things before we get out of here, before Chris gets in here and cleans up my mess. I want you to understand, if you're new in AA, welcome. I mean, you got thousands of people that love you already. It's the coolest thing. I want you to understand that you're going to be busy as quickly as you can. Some people seem to hit the ground running, and it's like they're on fire right off out of the gate. Mm-hmm. But my experience is that the vast majority are not. that the vast majority will do what I did, which is listen to a lot of nice people sharing opinions and ideas about stuff. And you'll always hear this stuff. Oh, sweetheart, you've only been sober for 6 months. You don't need to be out there doing that. Because I've been carrying messages. You come on, you'll be okay. Like, you're the most important guy in this room now. We hear this. And they mean well. I know that. But I'm telling you, based on the archival stuff, based on the outcome data from watching the historical part of AA for years and years and years, I'm a bit of a history nerd. What you'll find is that in the early days, that's all they talked about. Get sober, go help somebody. Get sober, go help somebody. There was no weird grace period that was left up to you to play games and drift sideways and get sick. And then maybe not come back. As I say this almost every time I do these talks like that, we've never, ever, ever had trouble getting people to come to AA. We have a hell of a time sometimes getting them to stay. And the reason that they don't stay is because they get drifty and goofy and sick again, like what Charlie and Katie were talking about. They get crazy again. And it's a weird deal to see somebody that's been in the rooms for 10 years and they're nuttier than a squirrel turd. This is crazy. And the surest way to make sure that they're not like that, that they don't get like that, is to get them involved in 12-step work. If you're brand new, go greet. There's a million things that you could do. Our meeting in Dallas, we've got 52 commitments a week to carry the message other places. 52. At one point in time, we had 13 commitments on Wednesday only, just on that one day, carrying the message to jails and treatment centers and wind-up joints and halfway houses and various things like this. That's the reason why our group originally got so big, was because all these people were going, well, I want to go where you go when I get out. Like, yes. Carrying this message was huge. It just was. One more real quick thing. I want to take this down to its base, just bottom line simplicity. In the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I did a talk about a year and a half ago at a group where I walked into the group, stood outside while they were smoking, and nobody said anything to me. And I'm dressed in a coat and tie. I'm the speaker that night. And I walk inside. Nobody said anything. I sat there for a little while. Eventually, a guy that I sponsored came over, visited with me, and some other folks came over. And then it was time for me to do my talk. But nobody ever really made me feel like I belonged there or that I was important at all. About 6 months later, I did a talk over in Fort Worth, and there was a group over there, and I pulled up out of in the parking lot. I got out of my truck, and I'm looking in the window of my truck trying to straighten my tie up. And when I turned around, there were 15 people standing next to my truck. I didn't even see them. They scared the crap out of me, and I didn't even see them. And I just kind of looked at them, and they had been out smoking outside, and they had grabbed a bunch of people from inside, and everybody had walked across the parking lot and greeted me when I got out of my truck. You see what the comparison, you see the two things that I'm talking about like this. Guys, we will never, there are a million people in AA that we will forget, but I can tell you, in all areas of your life, you will never, ever forget those people that showed you kindness, ever. That showed you kindness. And so we want to always make sure that when we are in a situation where we can be of service, where we can, if you're still trying to get your pins on the ground and trying to figure out what's going on, get as involved as you can in trying to greet. To this day, I've been sober for 32 years, and it's still my favorite job in AA. I cannot sit still. My goal in life is always to, as quickly as I can, get out there and try to greet some people and bring them into the room. It's just the coolest thing in the world. Guys, we stand real quick. We stand at this kind of turning point right now. We stand at a place at 85 years as a fellowship where we need to maybe be a little more sensitive to protecting our fellowship and making sure that we're doing the things that we're supposed to do. I love me a meeting, but I would rather that the center of our program be my deepening relationship with my Creator. I would rather it be my deepening relationship with the people about me and the places that I'm carrying the message than just going to a meeting. If your lifestyle lets you go to a meeting every day, go. But I don't want that to be the center of the program, because Bill never says that. He never carries that particular message like that. in order to protect your fellowship, in order to really feel it in your gut, you have to understand it. And the best way I know to understand it is to study it. That's the reason why I'm such a nerd around book studies, and why I love those meetings, because they changed everything about who I am and what I am and my ability to help others. Nothing is cooler than to be able to be in a position looking back where you recognize that a guy like me that was a total train wreck that offered really nothing except selfishness and self-centeredness and a whole bunch of chaos could be transformed through the loving hand of a God that I've come to understand into a guy who actually carried a message that had some depth and weight, and that I could get pretty excited, and that daily I get to watch miracle after miracle after miracle, and nothing is cooler than that. No. I love you guys. Thank y'all for letting me do that.
Hey, good job. My name is Chris R. from Ingram, Texas. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Does my hair look okay? Okay. I just making sure. I am honored. I can't tell you how cool it is to be here. I missed some of the earlier speakers I really wanted to hear. I had to go to an AA funeral. One of the things that happens in AA, you know, you end up going to a lot of funerals. I guarantee this lady had been sober forever, about 40 years, and it was so fun to sit in the back and watch that room fill up with folks in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and just there to support that family. And God is the absolute coolest. My wife Patty, she's at an AA wedding today, right now, so she can't be here. And you know, I mean, that's how cool that is. It's just, God, it's just the finest thing to be a part of a fellowship. 1987, I tried to take my own life, tried to commit suicide, because I had none of that around me. I was not a part of anything except my own little sick head. And it's just, I'm blessed, guys. 85 years, what an honor to be here and to be a part of this. I tend, Myers worries about tomato plants, and I just have a tendency to cry all the time. You know, I get a little emotional. I said, dadgum, this is pretty cool. Myers and I were raised here in the Hill Country. My father was an alcoholic and nicest, kindest, gentlest man you'd ever come across. Mom's an artist. I had two sisters. They didn't catch. Myers and I caught that little genetic bullet. And we became alcoholics. In high school, we started drinking. Bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine for me started the journey. Yay! All the old hippies are salivating. Yeah, it's good stuff. Anyway, Myers and I, after we graduated, we got in he had a Volkswagen Beetle with a bumper sticker on the back that said, "Get drunk and be somebody." I have no idea where that came from. But we drove to Houston, Texas, because we were going to be someone. Yeah. But, you know, through the hook and crook, I got a great job at a big old country club. I mean, a whole big hotel there, an apprenticeship program, and started doing some good stuff, and was pretty, I don't know, pretty successful. But I started moving around a bunch and making these little geographic moves. And I, unlike some people, the progression of the illness didn't catch up with me too fast. I had a bunch of years where I could drink and hold it together pretty good. And I finally got married. One of my geographics back to Houston, I got married to a nice girl and drug her up to North Texas to be closer to Myers. I had a job at a big old country club, and I came home one night. I'd just been drinking too much. You know, again, you know, you can't control how much you put in your system sometimes. And I drank too much and been doing some outside issues and it was a mess. And I don't remember what the fight was about, but, you know, she asked me to leave, and I came back a few hours later, and she, I finally got honest with her about how much I was drinking and how much trouble I was in around the alcohol. You got to this little place, great line in the book says, you can't imagine life living with it, and you can't imagine life living without it. It's like, that's where I got, you know, there's, alcohol works, guys, that sense of ease and comfort. Oh, I'm so grateful I had alcohol early. I mean, but it stops working after a period of time. You get that little sense of ease and comfort, and then 20 minutes later, the paranoia comes back, and the, you know, that low self-esteem, the bedevilments on page 52, and it just, hate my life, guys. And I'm seeing doctors. And anyway, I told her I'd quit. And a week and a half later, Chef asked me to have a beer with him after work. And I had one beer and pat myself on the back because I didn't get drunk. But that wasn't my deal with that nice lady. My deal was that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And I'd gone to AA that week, and, you know, and she left and should have. I had a bunch of years left in me. But I spent the next 7 years up in North Texas in and out, and I'm taking a shot at those people, just like what Meyer said. They're the most wonderful people on earth. You know, made me feel welcome, and they were sweethearts. But at the time in our history, at that time, this was early 80s, it just wasn't – I didn't have a big book. Nobody in the room was carrying a big book. We were talking about your cat again, and it was great. I mean, it was okay. But I'd sit in those meetings, and my friend Charlotte says it. She said, we'd sit in these meetings and wait to be offended. You know, I'm building a case against you because y'all are going around. It's a first step meeting, and y'all are telling your story, and I can't relate to your story, guys. If you'd have connected it to the symptoms, maybe I could have. But you're talking about drunk driving charges and robbing liquor stores and going to jail, and I can't identify with that. Don't get mad, guys. I know there's a lot of you in there because you love your story. And Friday night, you better have one. But we're scaring a lot of people away from AA. Bill Wilson was pretty clear. He wrote the stories in the front of the book in More About Alcoholism. Those are all high bottom drunks he's writing about. So, I mean, he's trying to paint a picture. You don't have to lose it all to qualify to be one of us. You have to lose choice and control. Anyway, I'm in and out for a bunch of years. I'm on 7 prescription medications, literally. And I'm seeing a doctor, psychiatrist at times. My brother gave me a job. Thank God for family. I'd have been on the street. The depression's kicking my butt, guys. I watch a lot of people, you know, I drink because I'm depressed. Yeah, no kidding. You know, number one symptom of untreated alcoholism is depression. Anyway, fast forward, guys. I went home one night and picked up a stack of return checks and just was done. I was so discouraged. And I'd been in AA. I'd been in IOP. I'd done everything. Tried to commit suicide. November 13th, it was a Friday the 13th, 1987, is when I walked back in the door. I aborted that attempt. I believe God intervened. Some power greater than myself did, I guarantee you. And Friday the 13th at 6 o'clock, I walked back in the back of an AA meeting, and little old girl stopped me from leaving the room. And they went around the room. I got to tell you guys, because this chairperson had seen me in North Texas, and he looked at me and he said, why don't we tell Chris how our lives have changed as a result of working the steps? Now, I've never seen that. I've never heard that before. I've heard people for 7 years trying to scare me into recovery. We got to stop doing that, I think. I'm going to share my experience. It might be different than yours, guys. Don't get cranky with me. I'm tired of the people. Yeah. They went around the room and talked about getting their credit cards back. Talked about starting a little business. A guy had a little landscape business right across from me, and he was all excited about making a little money for a change. And the girl at the end of the table had a little car keys, and she got her a new car. And I get people send me emails from all over the world because I get to speak out a lot. And they say, oh, Chris, you think every meeting ought to be a pep rally? Yes, I do. There was a lady at the end of the table. She had a sketch pad. I'm a big art fan. Guys, I come from a family of world-famous artists, and I am completely talentless. But I love art. And, you know, she'd gone back to school. And I mean, I'm 35 years old, guys, and I picked up a chip at the end of the meeting. Didn't know it was going to be my last one. I picked up hundreds of chips, guys. Unlike my twin brother, who was obviously a lot smarter than me, he picked up one chip, and I picked up a drawer full of them. And on the way out, these two guys stopped me and asked me if I'd sit for a few minutes, and they opened the big book, and they showed me that circle triangle in the front of the book that we used to have. But one day we're going to get it back in the book, guys. We're going to lobby one day, the Recovery Unity Service. And that they sat down with me for a few minutes, and they just explained for the first time, not making this up, folks, they explained the physical craving and the mental obsession. And they asked me about, had I worked the steps? No. Did I have a home group? No, I'd never had. I just go wherever's convenient. And did you ever do service work? How many people did you sponsor in 7 years? None. He said, that's why you can't stay sober. Brother, if you'll come in here and work the steps quickly, get through this work and start helping others, your life will change forever. I said, I don't really believe that. He said, we don't care if you believe it or not. Would you do it? And they did. They showed me in that book, guys, while we were talking about it. He says, helping others, page 97. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. What is this, a secret handshake nobody's going to tell me for 7 years? Because they're telling me for 7 years that going to a meeting every day is the secret handshake. You know, just not knocking that, guys. We're getting a name for ourselves. It sounds like we're knocking at, you know, our meetings. Our fellowship is wonderful, folks. I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying you can go to meetings until your hair falls out and not stay sober if you're a real alcoholic. You might need to do something a little different to have that spiritual experience. Anyway, these guys got me on my knees the next morning, and we did a third step prayer. And guys, I got to tell you, I started working on a fourth step right then. And 2 weeks later, I'm sitting on the tailgate of my truck, and it clear as the day, it dawns on me that the obsession to drink is lifted. And the next week, they railroaded me, guys. They said they had an opening as for the chairman of the cleanup committee there in Louisville. And I thought, you know, because I'm in the food business, I know how to clean a kitchen. I'm like, I could share this. And anyway, they listen, unanimously voted me in as chairman. And I asked the guy at the end of the meeting, I said, buddy, could you give me a list of my committee so that I can get with them and we can organize a cleaning rotation so we could get this place cleaned up? And they both spit coffee out at the same time. They were laughing their butts off. He says, Chris, there's no committee. You're it. I like, well, they railroaded me. All right. But I got to tell you, and I can't not tell it, I'm 2 days later, I remember they gave me the keys to the place. And Myers let me off work that afternoon. I don't know if he remembers it or not, but he let me off work. And I went in there about 1 o'clock, and the meeting was at 6 o'clock. And I sat there, and I cleaned that place, buddy. I vacuumed, and I cleaned those old, you know, those coffee pots that got all that browns? I mean, what is that stuff? I cleaned those coffee pots and that bathroom. Let's don't even talk about that AA bathroom, you know. And I got all that cleaned up. And I'm sitting back there in my little Frugaloon T-shirt soaking wet about 5:30. And waiting for the meeting to start, I made a pot of coffee, and I heard this lady walked in. She was the matriarch of the group, and she walked in, and I heard her squealing in the kitchen. And she looked around the corner, and she said, "Chris, she said, did you clean this place?" You know, I just stood up, and if I'd had a tie, I'd have straightened it. Yes, ma'am. And she walked around behind me with little bony arms and gave me a little back hug like that, and she said, "We need you." Man, y'all got any idea how long it had been since anybody had said that to me? You know, we need you to not call here anymore, son. You know, we had that, you know, yeah. We need you to put your hands behind your back. I got that one time. It was like, but they created a monster, buddy. For the 5 years I was at that group, and you couldn't go in there with muddy feet. I'd eat your butt. I got to tell you, but these guys said it, guys. You got to start working with others. I'm going to show you something. On the bottom of page 129, I could read a whole bunch. Even if he displays a certain amount of neglect and irresponsibility towards the family, it is well to let him go as far as he likes in helping other alcoholics. During those first days of convalescence, this will do more to ensure his sobriety than anything else. Maybe I misread that. Let me look at that again. During those first days of convalescence, they didn't say wait a year. They didn't say wait 2 years. I was so blessed, guys. I just got to say, I was so blessed to be around a whole bunch of people, that men and women in that group, that knew that if I didn't get busy, that I was not going to stay sober. I think maybe if we make one mistake in AA, it's that we got a bunch of people sharing opinions about how sober you have to be before you can go help somebody, or you can clean up the club, or make coffee, or be on this committee. I mean, I had people in that group lying about how long I'd been sober so they could get me on every committee out there. Because the more involved I got in service, the less I was up in my little head telling me I was a loser. It changed everything, guys. Bill Wilson, Founders Day, right after this, we're going to do a we'll do a video afterwards that's pre-recorded, the little history sites, and they're going to go up to the Mayflower Hotel. I've had an opportunity to get toured up there, and I stood right there where Bill Wilson walked out of that elevator, and he made a decision. I'm going to go drink, or I'm going to go find an alcoholic to work with. You read Language of the Heart. It says, I knew then I needed another alcoholic as much as that alcoholic could ever need me. No longer a preacher or a teacher. I mean, he knew that he needed to go find a drunk. And a few calls later, he ended up with Dr. Bob. The next day they met. And that 15-minute meeting that Dr. Bob was going to grant this drunk from New York turned out to be plus 5 hours. Because they got in there just like we do. Little alcoholics just getting together, and they start sharing their stories. And there's a bond. Bill Wilson says, and something passed between us. Yeah, you better believe it. That singleness of purpose that Bill Wilson wrote in there in our traditions and helped us stay on the path, that's exactly what that's about. We've been there. We know how to get out. We know how to do this. Bill wrote a little article real quick. I don't want to run out. Wrote a little article called The Dilemma of No Faith. Grapevine, back in the day, Grapevine had some great articles in there. You can get it in their archive stuff. This was in 1961 when he wrote this. This was, 10 years before he passed away in 71. So he was already seeing stuff. Though 300,000 have recovered, or not recovering, have recovered in the last 25 years, maybe a 500,000 more have walked into our midst and then out again. We can't well content ourselves with the view that these recovery failures were entirely the fault of the newcomer themselves. Perhaps a great many didn't receive the kind and amount of sponsorship they so sorely needed. We didn't communicate when we might have done so. So we AAs failed them. Guys, it was just, nobody's taking a shot at you, but somewhere along the line, guys in my sponsorship lineage, Mark was my sponsor for a year, and Gary B's my sponsor now. But in that lineage of ours, Don P. talked about it. He said, at a certain point, we stopped talking about recovery and started talking about sobriety. We kind of moved away from this, And unfortunately, a lot of us got, and I'm guilty of it back early on, a lot of us got to this place where we believed that if the newcomer needed something, they could ask. But folks, every time I would relapse, they would just scrape it off the side of the plate and say, well, I knew he didn't want it. Okay, but I did want it. When I told that nice little girl that I was married to that I wasn't going to drink anymore, I meant it with every fiber in my body. I've watched thousands come into treatment saying they want to get sober. But wanting to get sober and needing to get sober are two different things. Guys, it's not enough. If you can stay sober because you want to or need to, you're what the book calls a hard drinker, maybe. I don't know. The real alcoholic's going to have the thing called a spiritual experience, and that's guaranteed as a result of working the 12 steps and getting out there and kicking some butt. So I'm just saying, it changed everything for me, guys. Again, I was so fortunate that I had a bunch of men and women around me that continued to tell me what I could do. There are no don'ts in the big book, folks. There's some suggestions in the big book, but there's no don'ts in there. And this idea of, I've spoken in a thousand clubs, and you walk in and above the blackboard where the meeting schedules are, the bulletin board, you can't sponsor until you're 2 years sober. You can't sponsor until, guys, we got to stop. Because my experience is when the little newcomer comes in and he gets excited, and we teach him the steps and he has his spiritual experience, he has everything he needs to sponsor. We're not taking these people on to raise, folks. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a therapist or counselor. If they need one, I can hook them up with that. I'm a little alcoholic who absolutely could not take a drink. I'll never forget my first 30-day chip. I cried like a little kid. If I don't do anything stupid this year in November, I'll have 33 years. How did that happen? I'm sober a lot longer than Myers. I'm going to hold up the lamp, Myers, so you can see which way to come. I got to mention something real quick, folks, and in the short time I've got, I've watched a lot of people out there. There's this little thing in the spiritual warfare that takes place with us. This spiritual warfare is that little voice in your head. Charlie and Katie were referring to it earlier. They were talking about this little voice that says, you're a worthless piece of you know what, and you can't help anybody. And then when somebody, excuse me, reinforces that by telling you you're not sober long enough, guys, you may not be sober long enough today to go sponsor somebody or go lead a workshop, but you could darn sure get involved in some form of service work. I had this little girl I'd watched bounce around AA for years, and I was at a birthday meeting before we closed our meetings down, and we've reopened them now. We're all in there with masks on. We look like a bunch of little gangsters. I really look like a gangster. I've got a black eye patch and a mask. I'll be glad when this stuff is over. It's hurting my image. But real quick, I got to tell you, and this little girl was in there like that, and I see, you know how you can see when she sees that I see her, you know, and she ducked down behind this big old guy sitting in a meeting at the end, and she starts to try to skeet out of the meeting at the end after we say the Lord's Prayer, and I sneak over and grab her before she can get out. I said, "What?" And she said, "That was me. And she says, "Chris, I don't feel a part of this." And I looked at her for a few seconds and I said, "You're not. You just come to meetings. That's all you do. You sit in here and you don't visit. You don't talk to anybody. You don't go to dinner with us. You don't, if you would get involved, things would be different." That night after that meeting was our group conscience. And dang if I didn't come back with a cup of coffee and look over there and she was sitting in the front row. She'd come to her first group conscience. I remember mine. She volunteered to make coffee on Wednesday night, and she was in there making coffee like a big girl. And I saw her just the other night in the meeting. She's still there. You think there's a correlation? You better believe it, guys. That spiritual warfare, that stuff in your little head that's telling you you're worthless and you can't help anybody, guys, stop. There was a Jesuit priest one time at a workshop. He said, "Do you think the dark side, do you think Satan wants you dead?" And everybody said, "Yes, absolutely." He says, "He doesn't. Whatever the dark side is," he says, "it wants you ineffectual. It wants you alone, by yourself, sad, not doing life." Big Book paints this picture that we're supposed to re-enter the mainstream, but we're supposed to go kick some butt. Go paint pictures. Go write music. Go start a business. Come on, guys, what happens? So what if we fail? Let's just start something else. Do something else. But at least we're living for the first time. We're not holed up by ourselves wanting to take two bottles of pills and go to heaven. I don't know what to tell you, guys. William James, Bill Wilson wrote, had a volume of it when he was in detox the last time he went with Dr. Silkworth. One little quote for all of us, I think we need to pay attention going into this celebration and go back into our meetings. "Act as if what you do makes a difference." Why? Because it does. We got a whole bunch of people in here in this room right now, guys. Thousands of us. Do you think for a second that you got it figured out who God's going to use tomorrow to help you get through the next crazy thing guys, on this spiritual path, I don't know who God's going to use. I just know if we continue to suit up and show up and be of service to our fellows, that's how we stay sober. The old timers used to say it. I hear it all the time. You got to give it away to keep it. The old timers said, you got to give it away to get it. Get in there and be of service wherever you can, folks, and I guarantee it's going to come back to you. And we are so, it is so necessary now above everything. We got so many people because of this stupid virus stuff coming into treatment, coming into our meetings. I've never seen anything like it. We're going to be flooded with newcomers coming in. We're not going to have time to have that one old geezer in the corner that sponsors everybody. He can't do it. All hands on deck. Bill Wilson wrote a bunch of cool stuff about newcomers working with newer people. Yeah, you better believe it. Come on with us, guys, because I got to tell you, it's the best in the world. I sure love y'all. Thank y'all again. Thanks, Jeff, for asking us.